The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning, good day. This is the third in a three-part series on a certain class of mental activity that can make ourselves and sometimes others miserable, the process of papancha or distorting thought and views. And I want to start this talk. We're going to focus more on mental activity itself, how to work with it, how to recognize it, why it's what's helpful, what's not. And I want to start with a couple of little stories from my own life. So when my sister and I were maybe 8 and 9 years old, I was 9, she was 8, we were living in a pretty rural part of Tennessee, in a mountain area, and loved to play outside, had a big old yard. And that summer, for some reason, within a day of each other, we were out playing and both of us got stung pretty badly by bees. She had one stuck under her shirt. I had one stuck between my shoe and my sock foot. And it was unpleasant, you know, not fun at all. We both got over it. Neither of us were allergic, but it was a memorable part of the summer. And I mentioned that by way of introducing, I can't remember if it was that summer or the following summer, my whole family, the four of us, went hiking on the Appalachian Trail for, I don't know, 5, 7 days, something like that, just a little chunk of the Appalachian Trail. Gorgeous, gorgeous place. And one evening, it was starting to get dark. It was kind of wet and rainy. And so we set up our tents in a flurry in a kind of an off, well, let's just say it wasn't a formal camping spot, right? It was a little bit sloped. Our tent was like pushed up against a log to keep it from sliding down the hill. My parents were in one tent, my sister and I were in the other. But we got into bed comfy enough, slept all night. And then the next morning I woke up in my sleeping bag. Well, I wasn't even awake yet, but I was having this dream of a jaganhormous bee like this big and buzzing around a room. And it was not a pleasant dream. And then I woke up and it took me a few minutes to realize that the buzzing was still there. And it turned out that what had looked like dappled shade on the top of the tent with the sun filtering through was in fact hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of little creatures hanging out on the tent on the outside. And I was not happy. I woke up my sister. She was also not happy. And our solution to this problem was to call out to our parents, like, what do we do? Well, get out of the tent and go a ways away. So we wrapped ourselves in every item of clothing we had. We wrapped scarves around our faces and hat over our head and like multiple layers. It was as if we were expecting, I don't know what we were expecting. Ran out of that tent as fast as we could, you know, as far as we could away. And then my dad, bless him, took down the tent. I think he might have gotten stung once, if he got stung at all. It turns out these creatures were just sunning themselves to dry off after the storm. But the fear was real enough. So I'm telling this story because the way we relate to experience can define how we react. I was relating through a lens of fear, reacted a certain way. My father wasn't, reacted a completely different way. And we had very different subjective experiences, and all of us laughed about it, I don't know, days later, maybe the same day. But that process of mental expectation, mental filtering, can make such a difference in our subjective experience. Our entire subjective experience, in some ways, depends on the quality of the heart and the mind in the moment. So this feeds into papancha, which as I explained last time, is proliferating thought. It's named after a certain kind of weed in ancient India that spread. We have weeds like that here in the States. And papancha fueled perceptions also drive unhelpful interpreting or constructing of experience. Not unlike that swarm that was in my head, but only in my head. Right? So a swarm versus a just an experience in the world of our minds is often a completely subjective filtering choice. So the main points of this are that subjective process, and that humility and curiosity, simplicity are really helpful dispositions. And finally, how we relate to events before, during, and after the fact increases or decreases peace, ease, even a certain kind of authenticity. So you may remember, those of you who were here last week, I talked about these puzzled monks going to one of the senior teachers under the Buddha, trying to decrypt a very cryptic statement the Buddha said about basically, once there is no more basis for perceptions or thinking or papancha, proliferation, there's no more conflict, inner or outer. The way he said it, monks were like, run that by us again. Went to one of his senior disciples, Mahakacchana. And Kacchana described the perceptual process in detail and said a phrase that I just love, assailed by notions and perceptions, assailed by thinking and objectification. So, what to do when assailed? Since our minds interpret and construct experience, that humility piece is huge. And there's a couple of Pali words, the ancient language of the Buddha, that kind of have a similar meaning. One is saggarabha, which is respect or respectful, to let a thing, an experience, be itself. And there's also a direct word for humble heart and mind, nicca mano, which literally, I parsed the Pali last night and was delighted to discover that it literally means not conceit. So, not thinking ourselves better than, worse than, or even equal to. Not conceit. And this kind of humility is important because for most of us, much of the time, a staggering amount of the time in my own experience, some kind of self-centered processing that often includes greed, aversion, or delusion drives the constructive thingification, the objectification in our minds. Objectification is another translation for papancha. It drives erroneous thinking, even erroneous perceptions. To give a few examples, there's the classic simile in the discourses of mistaking a coiled rope for a snake. Startle. That's a subtle layer of fear informing the perception. Or, like me, during the sort of shelter in place phase of COVID, I was out hiking every single day up on the peninsula here. And one day I was walking along up on a sunny ridge and, in a very calm space, looked down and noticed that what I thought was a root was, in fact, a sunning snake. I stepped over it, it kept sleeping, we were both happy. But it was definitely a misperception that would have been consequential had I not noticed in time for both of us. So, even delusion, inattention can distort that expectation that a certain object shaped a certain way is a certain thing, changes the perception of the object so much that we might not really see until we take another look. Hatred, anger, rage also distort. Right. The teachings speak of rage making people ugly in our minds and contorting our own faces to be ugly. All of us have seen that, right? And greed or lust is a distortion in a different way. Oh, this will make me happy. This treat, this experience, this person, that's just going to do it for me. Even rose-colored glasses can be problematic at times. Seeing that, I mean, I remember seeing a colleague of mine at one point come into a room smiling. And at first, I thought he was smiling happy. And then I realized a moment or two later that it was a smile of pure rage. It was that kind of grimace. It's like, oh, good to notice before I interact with this person what kind of state of mind they're in. So often, even with these perceptual filters, people's experience of the exact same event can be dramatically different depending on the belief that's held, the theory, the kind of input that they've received in their lives in the past, all of it, and their own emotional mood in the moment. Before video cameras, I'll give two examples. The validity of a goal in a sports game, like a professional sports game, literally could come down to where the umpire or umpires were standing. Right? Literally, because the act of perception would shift based on their location, the conditions, the angle that they perceived. And then a little bit more metaphorically, some elders in my life were in law enforcement before they retired, and they used to talk about interviewing witnesses after a bank robbery. And there would be 17 witnesses and 19 stories about what happened. It's not that these folks were lying, it's that the conditions and biases and interpretations based on emotional state, based on the kind of day they were having, where they were, how they were brought up, all of that feeds into the formation of even what feels like a real perception. Maybe some of you have seen the movie Rashomon, very famous Akira Kurosawa film. He talks about this. He shoots the same event from several different witnesses' perspectives, and it's a different story every time. It's kind of a crime story. So each of us, whether there's a crime or not, will often have these different perspectives, these different angles. To keep that in mind is especially helpful during disagreements, during alternate versions of what has happened. Instead of relying on really entrenching myself in my belief or my understanding about what has happened, what is happening in my mind in the moment or in an interaction, the Buddha provides this brilliant alternative lens, a functional lens. What decreases suffering in the moment? What increases suffering in the moment? What aligns with the simplicity of what's happening now? Oh, unpleasant, or oh, very pleasant. One of a brilliant Buddhist thinker from another tradition, Tsongkhapa, from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, has a quote that I just love. He said, "I side with those who side with reality, because reality always wins." Reality doesn't necessarily have to have a lot to do with my perceptions of it. But if I stick with my body, with my direct experience and humility about my subjectivity, I'm grounded in the kind of reality Tsongkhapa is talking about. So that is a little bit of a riff about humility. I'll talk about simplicity for a few moments. What's so helpful about simplicity? It's that lack of a need for an internal argument case. Needing to be right, needing to construct things in a certain way, but rather just noticing things, especially in meditation, but even in life, as arising, when they're arising, it becomes much easier from a standpoint of simplicity to not quite be led around by emotions, beliefs, mind states so much. It's also easier with an orientation to internal simplicity, that kind of ouch I was talking about noticing the suffering in the moment, to avoid the proverbial second arrow the Buddha talks about. You know, life deals us something awful. That's the first arrow. The second arrow is blame, shame, complaint. It should be a different way. And then for many of us, there can be a third, fourth, 10th, 20th arrow on top of that. And before you know it, it gets really complicated in there. So, at whatever level of arrow we discover ourselves, our mind, our conditioning, making things worse, it's always helpful just to step back. Oh, this is the suffering. This kind of simplicity also helps to increase wisdom. Seeing thoughts, seeing proliferation, objectification as events in the moment. Seeing them as events helps to not grasp onto the ideas that are forming quite so hard. And papancha, mental proliferation without grasping, has no teeth. Instead, it becomes information. Information not about what I'm thinking about necessarily, but information about me, my own experience. Oh, this is how it feels right now. It increases a breadth of practice. And in my own experience, it also increases capacity for wisdom. That separation from subjectivity to, oh, simple. Yeah. There's a beautiful story from the night of the Buddha's awakening where Mara, many of you know this story. Mara is the personification of life-denying forces in Buddhism, kind of the devil figure, if you will. And Mara is like busting out all the stops to make sure the Buddha doesn't wake up, sending his forces of greed, of hatred, of delusion, of temptation, all of this kind of stuff. And Mara's army starts shooting arrows at the Buddha. And metaphorically, I take this metaphorically, the arrows are coming. And the Buddha simply says, I see you, Mara. And the arrows transform to flowers. And that is what wisdom does to mental activity. I see you. Oh. Wisdom. Wisdom arises. So, one more powerful approach is to be open to change, to be open. This is where this humility and simplicity kind of meet. To sort of a lightness, even a sense of humor about the foibles, you know, everything I'm describing here is basically baked into the human condition without a lot of development, right? Spiritual development, emotional development, psychological sophistication. A lot of this stuff is just, you know, they were writing about it almost 3 millennia ago. It's still happening today. We haven't changed all that much as humans. But a certain kind of lightness and humility and scope of like, oh, okay, that's just the mind doing its thing. That can be super helpful. And I've been listening to a podcast or two actually on the late Nobel Prize winner and phenomenally influential psychologist, Danny Kahneman. And One of the things he was most well known for, and it's absolutely charming to listen to recording of him doing this, is the delight he took when proven wrong. He would just laugh. Oh, my mind, it's doing that thing again. And had like this decade or so long collaboration with a friend where they would find these foibles in each other's minds with appreciation and respect. And just, it's not that they didn't take them seriously, they researched it. They didn't take it seriously in the sense that they didn't feel like it was their fault. Like, oh, this is how minds work. This is how minds have evolved without intervention. This is how they do things. So that lightness, that humor, that invitation to taking delight in a shift rather than it saying something terrible about me, myself, and mine, that shift is happening at all. The Buddha didn't talk about not having beliefs and views. He encouraged us not to have fixed beliefs and views. That letting go, that capacity for a little bit of laughter with a shift or a change of heart, it puts you on the way to something really beautiful. They do call the awakening process enlightenment, lighter. There's more perhaps to say, but I don't want to take up a whole lot more time. So just to say a few brief words about fruitfully working with mental proliferation. That, as I was saying earlier, first noticing the suffering. This is in the Four Noble Truths. Suffering exists. It's arising. Okay. To then notice moments where it abates or ceases, and trust that the practice itself can help it cease. Another practical way is to shift to body sensations. And as I've been talking about Vedana, feeling tone, oh, pleasant, unpleasant, cuts right through. And then the third way, which I introduced a little bit in the guided meditation, is investigation or inquiry. Dhammavicaya. It's a factor of awakening, and there's a reason for that. It's very powerful to maybe check the attitude in the mind and heart. Or one of my favorites, Andrea Fella came up with this, though I don't think she remembers it, assigning a thought a believability index between 1 and 100, 1 being BS and 100 being absolute verified fact. Just that act can start to separate the mind from being glommed on, stuck on to something unhelpful. My version of this early in my practice was I taped the words, "Are you sure?" to my bathroom mirror. Are you sure? Really? It's said in a loving way. So views, beliefs, past experiences shape perceptions, which shape those filters, which again shape perceptions and how we perceive events. And with a different context, different training, different life experience, those perceptions can change. So, part three of the honeybee story that I started with in the beginning, about I don't know, 12, 13 years after the event, I was in my early 20s. The events on the Appalachian Trail, a little bit more than that. I was in, maybe 13, 14 years later. I was solo hiking across southern Crete. I'd taken a little sabbatical and kind of accidentally found myself camped out overnight under the stars one night because I don't read Greek maps very well. And it was fine. I was sleeping under this amber tree and, stars and moon and distant goat bells. It felt very safe. And Before first light, when the sun first started to make the sky gray instead of pitch black, because believe me, there were no lights, I heard this buzzing, and it was strong enough that it vibrated my sternum. I woke up, looked up, looked around. I didn't see anything, and eventually, there, silhouetted against the gray sky, was a single bee hovering completely stock still. And I was like, well, okay, one bee does not make that much noise. So, got my clothes back on, layered up, and looked up again. And I saw, as far as the eye could see, hundreds of bees in formation, stock still, hovering about 5 feet apart from each other. And they were all centered around the tree I'd been sleeping under. I assume it was their hive or something. But it was magical. Like a bird would fly through and try to get one, and they would move just like fingers on a hand and go right back to their formation. So I was regarding them. I don't know if they noticed me, but I stayed kind of transfixed in awe until the moment the sun broke over the horizon, and boom, they disappeared. I saw one the entire rest of the day. But this time, rather than fear, there was this awe and communion that was present with these creatures. So I say that in part to relay the story, but more to highlight how different the different context can be of meeting something or someone with awe, interest, curiosity, openness, versus fear as the initial filter. The core of Buddhist practice is how we relate to what's happening. In all of this, our minds, beliefs, perceptions, we can learn to shift them when they're not serving us. Thank you for kind attention. May the practice we have done here together be of benefit to ourselves and to all of the lives we touch and all of the lives they touch. May those benefits ripple outwards and outwards. May all beings be safe, happy, well, peaceful, and free. Thank you for the sincerity of your practice. Feel free to unmute and say goodbye if you wish.
Thank you. See you next week, I hope.
Thank you.